The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Nicole Hunter from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Essence Magazine. For this particular month, we're going to be toggling back and forth between Essence and Ebony Magazine. The great part about this here in the new year, and happy new year to all of you, is that we have Michelle Obama, former first lady, that is on Essence Magazine, the cover, and also Ebony. So let's go ahead and get started. So the first issue that I am going to go over is Having Her Say. Forever, First Lady Michelle Obama opens up to Essence about the factors that shaped her, the art of balancing career, marriage, and motherhood, and what to keep top of mind when it comes to finding your Barack. Oh, yeah, she went there. Since leaving the White House 23 months ago, or, you know, actually more months ago than that, probably more so like 24, 25 months ago now, Michelle Obama had been keeping a well-earned and relatively low profile, spending time at home in D.C. with the family, vacationing with friends, catching up on novels, and writing the story of her life. Little Black girl from the South Side of Chicago grows up and becomes the first lady, or the first African-American first lady of the United States. But now things are about to change big time. With the November release of her much anticipated becoming Michelle Obama, age 54, it is a step back into the spotlight to where she was able to share her truth. Has her journey been extraordinary? Most definitely. But life ain't been no crystal stair. Her father suffered from multiple cirrhosis, or some people refer to it as MS. Teachers weren't always on her side. Campus life at Princeton University wasn't always welcoming, and plenty of the president's detractors were mean and racist. I've spent the last year and a half reflecting on my life, or on my story, as deeply and honestly as I could. She says, I want to inspire others to reflect upon and share their own stories, all the joys and sorrows, all the scars and renewals. Essence caught up with Michelle Obama back in November of 2018 and posed a wide range of questions, including what's next for her, and she answered. So prepare to be surprised, enlightened, and inspired. What was one aspect of your life as a young adult that helped shape the woman you became? And Michelle's response is, at birth, we're all surrounded by forces that we have no control over. And in becoming, I write about some of the factors that influenced me from an early age. Watching my neighborhood shift as white flight took effect, my parents' ability to foster confidence and independent thinking, the Sunday dinners I spent with a grandfather who moved north during the Great Migration, only to see his prospects stunted because of the color of his skin. That was the context I was dropped into as a little girl. One of the bigger factors I realize now was growing up with a father who had multiple cirrhosis, a neurological disease that affected his ability to move and accomplish daily tasks. My dad was diagnosed with MS as a young man, and while it never seemed to dampen his spirit, it did affect the way my family lived. The Robinsons were planners by necessity, climbing an extra flight of stairs, walking a quarter mile from a fairway parking spot. We couldn't just take those kind of things for granted. We had to have a plan. If we were going to one of my brother's basketball games, for instance, we'd leave the house long before the game time so my father could find a seat in the bottom few rows of stands, something he could reach with his crutches or later his wheelchair. This was before the Americans with Disabilities Act came into effect, and an accessible seat was often hard to find, if one existed at all. So that extra hour of preparation was the only way my dad could be certain he could watch his son's game with any degree of comfort. That level of planning filtered into my personality, too. In college, my friends teased me because I created a detailed year-long strategy to complete my thesis on time, and I actually stuck to it. The truth is, I'm still that kind of person. I practice every speech I give. I make a lot of long-term plans, and in all my years in the White House, when our world could get flipped upside down by a news story or a hurricane crashing ashore, one of the things that gave me peace of mind was having a concrete plan in place for our family. Not just for tomorrow, but for next week and the next few months. Of course, I'd often have to switch gears and be flexible, but I wanted to be sure as I could that the demands of the presidency didn't constantly pull me away from Malia's tennis matches or Sasha's dance performances. Even now, that same type of careful preparation is a big part of who I am. But before becoming our First Lady, you managed a busy career while building your marriage and having children. You were sometimes the higher earner in your family and traded in your professional career to serve our country. What advice would you give other women on navigating the intersections of love, life, career, and family while still trying to find our identities outside of what we do? This is a riddle that most families struggle to solve. And as we all know, the burden of figuring it out usually falls on the woman. Back before anyone in Tennessee or Montana knew who Barack Obama was, I was a vice president at a major hospital, juggling two little girls and a state legislator husband who was away from the home for large parts of many weeks. I'm not going to lie. It wasn't easy for me, but what I've learned is that all the frustrations, all the trials and errors, all of that is necessary work. The only way to find some balance is to live through a lot of imbalance. I'll share two pieces of advice. The first is that you've got to ask for help. I've learned that lesson many, many times, often the hard way. I think as women, we've internalized the idea that a modern professional woman should be able to do everything, to move mountains at work, to pack lunches for our kids every morning and tuck them in every night, to patch up torn jeans and decorate our homes perfectly, and attend every PTA meeting, all while fueling the fire of a marriage that belongs on the pages of a romance novel. It sounds so silly to say it out loud, but doesn't it? But in all our own minds, those expectations, even if we readily accept that they're unrealistic, can still feel like real pressure. They weigh us down and stress us out. They make us feel like we're failing. They're a straight line to self-defeat. When I was raising young children, I learned to lean on a group of my friends in Chicago, women who, like me, had jobs and partners and children who kept them moving every minute. We'd help one another in very concrete ways, like picking up each other's kids for dance lessons or a birthday party or anything else that came up. If one of us was in a pinch at work or had a sudden change of plans, we knew we had a few folks on our speed dial we could count on to fill in some gaps. Of course, we leaned on our husbands as well, and grandparents and extended family chipped in too. But for me, there was something special, something vital, even about sharing this experience with other women who were going through the same kinds of stresses and challenges that I was. Looking back, what often made the most difference wasn't the support amid a moment of crisis or drama, but the mundane Saturday afternoons when we'd just hang out together in someone's kitchen, our toddlers playing on the floor, and infants sleeping on our chest. It was just life, but sturdier. My second piece of advice is sort of an inverse of my first, and that's to make sure to take some time for yourself. We've all got to practice self-care. Whatever that means to you, it might be carving out some time for exercise, maybe taking an evening walk or doing some yoga in your bedroom before anybody else wakes up. It might be dropping the kids off with a friend and curling up in the darkness of a movie theater to watch a rom-com with a tub of popcorn and a box of tissues. It might be setting a FaceTime date with your best friend across the country. The point is that you've got to take a moment, maybe once a day, maybe once a week, to just say, I'm sorry, everybody, but I'm doing this for me. You're no good to anyone if you're no good to yourself. What's your advice on finding a significant other? How can other Michelles find their Barack? I think a lot of people don't have a clear idea of what they should look for in a mate. And for a long time, I didn't either. Sometimes we get swept away by external measures like someone's physical attractiveness, their earning potential, maybe the kind of job they have or the car they drive. Other times, we might overlook red flags in potential partners, thinking that enough love might change them. We hope that someone who's unfaithful during a courtship will miraculously change because of a ring on his finger. That someone unwilling to be vulnerable will suddenly open up. What drew me to Barack is that when I met him, he was already a fully formed individual. From our very first conversations, he showed me that he wasn't afraid to express his fears and doubts, and that he might not have all the answers. He could handle someone with her own passions and goals, someone who had ideas of her own. He relished it. In fact, I liked that. Just as important, I saw who he was not only in the way he treated me, but in the way he interacted with others outside of our relationship. He showed me that he respected women by the way he treated his mother, his sisters, and his grandmother. I saw his loyalty through his consistency with the friends he'd had since high school, his ethics by the way he dealt with money, his worldview by the way he'd dedicated himself toward causes that were larger than just a bank account, and his compassion and desire to fight for folks who didn't have much power. I saw his immense capacity to love and be loved. And importantly, I knew all those attributes would make him a good father someday. These were all things I learned long before we were married. It was all on display when we dated. He was consistent, he was honest, he was respectful, and he was secure in himself and secure in us. He hasn't been perfect, but those things have never wavered. So what I'd say to anyone uncertain about choosing a partner is to take seriously the things you see while you're dating, the good and the bad. And if you really respect each other as individuals, if you can laugh with little things when little things go wrong, if you'd had some success working together through some of the tangled knots that spring up in every relationship, then you've got a good start on building a relationship that can last. Okay, let's do a few quick questions or few quick ones. What were your happiest days in the White House? Any day that I got to spend time with children was a good day. Sometimes if I was in need of a pick-me-up, my staff would schedule an event with young people to give me a boost. Kids give me energy. They get me out of my own head and remind me about the things that are most important. What were your saddest days in the White House? It's hard to feel much lower than visiting a community that had been ravaged by a mass shooting. I still can't imagine what it must feel like to have a loved one taken away so senselessly. When I was with these families, I had just tried to do whatever I could, to hug tightly, to pray deeply, even to just stand together for a few minutes of silence and tears. It's something we're all so used to now, the cycle from shock to grief, from helplessness to anger to complacency and back again. But there are too many families in anguish, too many lives and extinguished too soon for us to just accept it as a fact of life. You feel all of that when you visit these communities. You can't just turn the channel. What's next for you? Since we left the White House, I've spent most of my time focusing on finishing this book. The book tour helped to keep me busy for a while, or will help to keep me busy for a while. And then I'll take some time to evaluate what's next. I'm in no hurry. What I know is that public service is in my DNA. So I'm planning to find ways to keep being useful. For instance, back in October, we launched the Global Girls Alliance through the Obama Foundation. It's an effort to help adolescent girls around the world get the education they deserve. I see myself always staying involved in efforts like that. Exclusive book excerpt. Forever First Lady Michelle Obama reflects on a challenging childhood experience and shares the lifelong lesson learned. When it came time to look at colleges, I spent a weekend visiting my brother Craig at Princeton, where he seemed to have slipped into a productive rhythm of playing basketball, taking classes, and hanging out at a campus center designed for minority students. The campus was large and pretty, an Ivy League school covered with ivy, and Craig's friends seemed nice enough. I didn't overthink it from there. No one in my immediate family had much in the way of direct experience with college, so there was a little, anyway, to debate or explore. As had always been the case, I figured that whatever Craig liked, I would like, too, and that whatever he could accomplish, I could as well. And with that, Princeton became my top choice for school. Early in my senior year at Whitney Young, I went for an obligatory first appointment with the school college counselor to whom I'd been assigned. I can't tell you much about the counselor because I was deliberately and almost instantly blotted this experience out. I don't remember her age or race or how she happened to look at me that day when I turned up in her office doorway, full of pride at the fact that I was on track to graduate in the top 10% of my class at Whitney Young, that I'd been elected treasurer of the senior class, maybe the National Honor Society, and managed to vanquish pretty much every doubt I'd arrive with as a nervous ninth grader. I don't remember whether she inspected my transcript before or after I announced my interest in joining my brother at Princeton the following fall. It's possible, in fact, that during our short meeting, the college counselor said things to me that might have been positive and helpful, but I recall none of it because, rightly or wrongly, I got stuck on one single sentence the woman uttered. "I'm not sure," she said, giving me a functory, patronizing smile that you're Princeton material. Her judgment was as swift as it was dismissive, probably based on a quick glance calculus involving my grades and test scores. It was some version, I imagine, of what this woman did all day long with practice efficiency, telling seniors where they did and didn't belong. I'm sure she figured she was only being realistic. I doubt that she gave our conversation another thought. But failure is a feeling long before it's an actual result. And for me, it felt like that's exactly what she was planting. A suggestion of failure long before I'd even tried to succeed. She was telling me to lower my sights, which was the absolute reverse of everything my parents had ever taught me. Had I decided to believe her, her pronouncement would have toppled my confidence all over again, reviving the old thrum of not enough, not enough. But 3 years of keeping up with the ambitious kids at Whitney Young had taught me that I was something more. I wasn't going to let one person's opinion dislodge everything I thought I knew about myself. Instead, I switched my method without changing my goal. I would apply to Princeton and a scattershot selection of other schools, but without any more input from the college counselor. I sought help from someone who actually knew me, Mr. Smith, my assistant principal and neighbor. had seen my strengths as a student and furthermore trusted me with his own kids. He agreed to write me a recommendation letter. I've been lucky enough now in my life to meet all sorts of extraordinary and accomplished people, world leaders, inventors, musicians, astronauts, athletes, professors, entrepreneurs, artists and writers, pioneering doctors and researchers. Some of them are women. Some are black or of color. Some were poor or had lived lives that many of us would appear to have been unfairly heaped with adversity. And yet, still they seem to operate as if they've had every advantage in the world. What I've learned is this. All of them have had doubters. Some continue to have roaring, stadium-sized collections of critics and naysayers who will shout, "I told you so," at every little misstep or mistake. The noise doesn't go away. But the most successful people I know have figured out how to live with it, to lean on the people who believe in them, and to push onward with their goals. That day, I left the college counselor's office at Whitney Young. I was fuming, my ego bruised more than anything. My only thought in the moment was, "I'll show you." But then I settled down and got back to work. I never thought getting into college would be easy, but I was learning to focus and have faith in my own story. I tried to tell the whole thing in my college essay. Rather than pretending that I was madly intellectual and thought I'd fit right inside the ivy-strewn walls of Princeton, I wrote about my father's MS and my family's lack of experience with higher education. I owned the fact that I was reaching. Given my background, reaching was really all I could do. And ultimately, I suppose that I did show that college counselor, because 6 or 7 months later, a letter arrived in our mailbox on Euclid Avenue, offering me admission to Princeton. My parents and I celebrated that night by having pizza delivered from Italian Fiesta. I called Craig and shouted the good news. The next day, I knocked on Mr. Smith's door to tell him about my acceptance, thanking him for his help. I never did stop in on the college counselor to tell her she'd been wrong, that I was Princeton material after all. It would have done nothing for either of us. And in the end, I hadn't needed to show her anything. I was only showing myself. And that was, again, an exclusive excerpt from former First Lady Michelle Obama's book titled Becoming. So if you haven't got a copy of her book, I'm sure it's on sale at, all types of outlets and, different different stores and even online. But anyway, let's move on there's so much to go over this time of the year. So, and it looks like we don't have that much time left. So let's see, something else is fun. Let's go over love and life goals. So, it's time to get busy living your most inspired life in a world where we are inundated daily with crazy headlines. It is more important than ever that we focus on making our dreams our reality. Here's your guide to clarifying your vision for the coming year and manifesting your best season yet. Number one, declare your dreams. First things first, list your intentions and desires. When we set goals that promise rewards, the brain releases dopamine, says Joseph Asaroff, author of Inner Size, the new science to unlock your brain's hidden power. Asaroff emphasizes that the very promise of a reward releases dopamine, just as the actual experience does. Dopamine that then travels to your frontal lobe, where it gives you the motivation and ability to plan and develop strategies and then to act, he adds. Think of dopamine as the brain fuel in your motivational tank. I learned the importance of setting goals the hard way. I'd never made it an object to meet Oprah Winfrey. So when I was in the same room with her in 2016, it didn't occur to me to make it happen. I was determined to not repeat that mistake. So when I sat down to write goals for the following year, I included these simple words, meet Oprah. Number two, define your why and how. Once you've identified what you want, take a few moments to clarify why it matters and how you will get there. Thinking about why we're doing something activates a different part of the brain from the region that is activated when we think about how to do something. As Roth explains, by activating both regions of the brain, he says, you shift from the realm of imagination to beliefs, actions, and productive habits. Your why can be connected to the long-term impact of a goal and what it means to your life and others, including our ancestors. For inspiration on your how, I recommend an activity I call the Crazy Eight, in which you list a big dream in eight ways it could come true. My Crazy Eight for meeting Oprah range from randomly bumping into her to being a guest on Super Soul. When I got clear on my whys and how to connect with Mrs. Winfrey, I started working on what I would say. Number three, and the final one for this week's episode, celebrate small wins. As you make a plan, break actions into bite-sized tasks and celebrate wins along the way. Some parts of your brain are designed to set goals for the future, while others lean to the immediate gratification, Asaroff says. So before you release those extra pounds, take a bow for that reorganized kitchen and that gallon of water you drink every day for a week straight. Long-term goals require ongoing motivation, which can be supported by regular dopamine infusions, Asaroff says. When you check something off your to-do list, it gives you a piece of satisfaction. We're going to stop there, but, you know, next week we're going to go over some more because there is, you know, a few more that we can go over when it comes to your goals for 2019. Again, we've run out of time for today's episode of Essence Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Nicole Hunter, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, www.trianglereadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long until next time.